Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Ten years ago, as I was beginning to articulate for myself the connections between progressive political values and bioethics around issues like genetic engineering, I ran across the novel Schismatrix by Bruce Sterling. Bruce was already quite famous in science fiction circles as the principal ideologist of the cyberpunk science fiction subgenre, along with William Gibson of the Neuromancer fame, mathematician Rudy Rucker, and Lewis Shiner. Bruce had published a genre newsletter and edited the central 1986 Mirror Shade cyberpunk anthology. Schismatrix outlined the potential lines of subspeciation of the human race fractured by the adoption of cybernetic and genetic technologies, and most strikingly suggested how collective identities might be shaped to bridge these coming schisms. And that problematic has inspired me in my research in empirical bioethics since then, and I'm delighted to finally speak to the author. Welcome, Bruce Sterling.
Hello.
So I want to start in the territory I'm sure you're very familiar with, which is a definition of what cyberpunk was about and where it's gone since then. Your cyberpunk was in reaction to things that had occurred before, the traditional schisms between hard science fiction and soft science fiction. And how do you commonly characterize this, what it was doing?
Well, you know, of course I'm always asked this question, and, you know, how does one define all this and so forth, and, you know, yeah, I'd like to acknowledge that it was indeed all my fault, and, you know, that it really seemed like a good idea at the time, okay? I was trying to find a way and room to sort of rethink the genre's stale ideas and come up with a more appropriate and more contemporary approach to technological issues, and I was tired of robots and rocket ships and wanted to write about computers and modems for a while. So, you know, I think it worked out very well. It was certainly very useful, and people still ask me about it, you know, many years later. I don't think there are many other pop culture people from 1984 who probably get interviewed about what they were doing in 1984.
I see shows like that occasionally on MTV, but they're usually about how pathetic things were.
Yeah, well, they're usually, you know, middle-aged, tired, washed-up, one-hit wonder, new wave band guys. Instead of like, yeah, that's when we made our first million, and then, well, the heroin hit me, and, you know. But luckily, I'm not a musician. I am, in fact, a novelist. So instead, I get things like two-page spreads in Time magazine and worshipful coverage from Locus magazine and forth and so on. Now, I'm becoming very much the grand old man figure these days.
Well, I have a picture of you up on the website for a radio show that's stolen from your website, and it shows that you're very much not an old man yet. But
but you should have seen me when I was young and beautiful.
Wow. One of the things that characterized your colleagues' approach to science fiction was straddling the fence between Luddism and technophilia, that you were someplace in a kind of critical embrace of technology. Is that the way you see it?
The Luddism and technophilia, I mean, what are those? Those are two extremes. You know, if you're straddling the fence there, that's basically all of human activity that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Luddism is something that is people came up with in a spasm of desperation and pure sort of technophilia in the sense of like absolutely worshiping any gizmo that comes along is just, it's for fools,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But there's a lot of that in traditional science fiction. A lot of technophilia that doesn't look at any of the downsides or unforeseen consequences of technology.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's one of the great organs of the American technological sublime. I just sort of claim that because some gizmos knew that, you know, it's inherently fantastic. I mean, the problem with the sense of wonder is that the sense of wonder is a very temporary thing. It really eats its young because people just don't feel wonder very long. And I can remember the wonder I first felt when I was on the Internet, and now I can sit here and, you know, I can web surf while I'm doing my daughter's homework, and you know, for me, I suppose there's still some small element of surprise and joy and amazement there, but for my children, it's just another glass box.
Another one of the aspects of your fiction that caught my attention early on was Islands in the Net, which accepted the traditional cyberpunk view, or at least some cyberpunk writers' view, that corporate capitalism would be ascendant over national governments, but took it one step further to suggest that there might be opportunities for social experimentation within corporate structures. Is that a way that you would characterize Islands in the Net? It was kind of a cooperative socialism within a transnational corporation.
Well, you know, I think it's politics, and I think politics goes on, and I think there are interests involved, and there are motives involved, and it doesn't matter whether you wave a flag or whether your power group controls a certain territory. I mean, those are all historical accidents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing set in stone about the nation state. You know, years ago we didn't have any. There are some still right now that are sort of not accepted. There are pariah states. And, you know, it's a system that has sort of come up, but it's not like it's divinely ordained. It's just the way things sort of happen. So, you know, the mere fact that corporate power might conceivably be more powerful than a nation state under certain circumstances doesn't mean that corporate power itself wouldn't evolve, or that, you know, the nation state's over and therefore private enterprise runs everything forever. I think that what has happened is that in fact the nation state has lost a great deal of power, and that in fact corporations have not had it together to pick it up. You know, there isn't really a market. I mean, there's a market economy, but it's by no means dominated by kind of Japanese feudal corporations. I think it turns out, you know, historically it's turned out that corporations are incredibly weak.
Mm-hmm.
They really just can't manage to run anything, and I guess their problem is that they're not loyal to their employees. They turn out to be loyal to their stockholders. And the stockholders really don't want them to be very strong. The stockholders feel no particular loyalty to any enterprise over any other. It's a remarkably unstable situation.
In the late 80s, a lot of science fiction writers, and especially cyberpunk people, were looking to Japan as a model for different kinds of social experiments. And
yeah.
That seems to have evaporated with the Japanese economy.
Well, it's like the Japanese say, you know, it's gone from Japan bashing to Japan nothing. You know, they've had an eight-year decline, economic decline, of recession or depression, I guess you could almost call it, and I don't think they're coming out of it. I think they could go on like this for, you know, almost indefinitely. I think they had a tremendous opportunity in the 1980s to sort of put their political ducks in a row and really just get the bit between their teeth and become a superpower, but I think that when the ad opportunity came up, they just had some strange crisis of confidence. Well, I used to go hang out in Japan in the middle 80s, and I still have good friends there, and it was really a delightful place, and I think very inventive and interesting, but since they lost all the money, and since their, you know, numerous political and bribery scandals, which they were never able to put behind them, I just, you know, it's difficult to feel optimistic about them. They've really done themselves some terrible harm.
I lived actually in Japan for a year and couldn't agree more. That's the Japanese mood is entirely different from what it was in the 80s. In terms of your own body of work, the 1990 collaboration with William Gibson, for many of your fans and followers, marked a turning point away from the traditional interests of cyberpunk towards, that novel was called steampunk. It seems to have launched a whole subgenre of its own called steampunk. But again, exploring the unforeseeable consequences of technology, in this case through technological extrapolation. Do you see your own historical or personal era in that way, that the beginning of the 90s was when you started to go in a different direction?
You know, the first time we ever met, we were talking about early computation. And the thing about writing a book set in the 19th century or an alternate 19th century, as well as those that are set in the future, is that, you know, we actually think historically. Or at least I do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, traditionally, the science fictional approach has been to think of the past as a sort of vast, inert, meaningless thing, and the future as this stage show where literally anything can happen, and it's going to be, you know, some fantastic, ludicrous, phantasmagoria type thing where you could project your own wishes and desires against an empty canvas. And in point of fact, the future is history. It's just history that hasn't happened yet. And history holds the keys to genuine understanding of our predicament and our trends and so forth. So I really don't think you can think seriously about technology or society without a historical perspective. So, you know, to go back and forth, I mean, people pretended to be shocked when we were writing about things, you know, backward. But if you actually read Difference Engine, the approach in it and the thinking and the way the book is structured is very much in line with things we've been doing all along.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a very nice compendium that went along with it from Science Fiction Eye, where they translated all the historical terms that you had reinvented for it. Now, along in 1992, you did The Hacker Crackdown, which was a book of nonfiction, and took the step of releasing that on the net, kind of living up to the old anti-intellectual property slogan of the hackers, knowledge wants to be free. You allowed people to copyright, to copy the volume itself, and it was perceived as a defense of the hacker subculture, and you've been very involved in civil libertarian issues since then. Is that obviously with the Communications Decency Act and other campaigns, that's still a going concern?
Oh, yeah, it's very lively, but I think the thing that I predicted in the last chapter of the Hacker Crackdown has very much come true. I mean, it ends with the observation that it's the end of the amateurs and this, and I think that nowadays the civil liberties and computer crime scene are very much more professionalized than they were 10 years ago. You know, you have people who are involved in these issues, but they're people who are ACLU people or, you know, regular sort of free expression and civil rights people. And, you know, there are guys who are willing to sort of show up in a tie every day in Congress. And it's become a very standard kind of freedom of the press issue. I mean, I'm still extremely interested in it, of course, because, I'm interested in freedom of the press. I'm interested in things that are done on paper. I'm a writer, and free expression is very much my bailiwick, and I'll always be interested in that. But I don't think that scene really requires the attention of sort of visionary lunatics like myself now. You know, I have a lot of friends in that milieu. I go hang out with them. We had a very nice Computers, Freedom, and Privacy meeting here 2 years ago, where I actually invited the entire convention to come over to my house, which they did. I literally bought every one of them a beer, you know. So, you know, I can still do things for them, and I still take them very seriously, and of course I have a lot of friends there. But I'll never write another book along that line, even though I get tons of fan mail from hackers demanding that I do it. It was the proper time to have done that. I was ahead of my time. I'm supposed to be ahead of my time. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't do it again now because it's just too obvious how important this is. You can't turn around without finding an HTTP address on stuff. You know, the Internet has saturated our society now.
Right. Well, your attention most recently seems to have turned to global climate change. You wrote a novel in 1994 called Heavy Weather, which projected the effects on tornadoes and hurricanes and other climate phenomenon of climate change. And your Viridian Manifesto of January 3, 2000 has been published on the net, and you have quite a few ideas in there. I have a couple quotes here from that. It seems to be principally an environmental document. You say the left is out of ideas while the right is delusional. With government crippled and industry brain dead to any conceivable moral appeal, the future of decentered autonomous cultural networks looks very bright. So your appeal is mainly to artistic and creative types, and you're trying to create an artistic vanguard to fight global climate change.
Yep.
And it's an explicitly green document, and your Viridian part of it comes Society must become green, but not the old-fashioned greens of natural, spiritual, primitive-esque blood and soil. The world needs a new, unnatural, seductive, mediated, glamorous green of Viridian green that can convince the 20th century that the industrial base is crass and gauche and filthy.
And beautiful piece of work.
It's a very nice set of statements.
Yeah, it's a lovely piece of rhetoric there. That's really some of the best propagandistic writing I've ever done.
I've always been partial to manifestos myself.
Well, I think I traditionally done a lot of my best work for nothing. just not paid for it. And this particular effort, it's something that I could do by myself, and I think that's appealing to me. I certainly had some experience of what it's like to be politically active when I was hanging out in electronic frontier circles, and I really don't think political activity suits me very well. I understand it and I respect the people involved in it, and it's not like I want to ignore it. I just don't think it suits my proclivities. I think my proclivities are I should write challenging and visionary and imaginative things and just sort of cast out ideas and let other people make of them what they will.
Well, you've written this in the we person. Or is there a we that was collaborating with you on this? Or?
Well, you know, I got 400 or 500 people on Viridian list now.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's always a we as long as there's an audience.
How does one subscribe?
If it were literally something I were doing myself, I wouldn't bother to tell anyone, would I?
How does one subscribe to Viridian List?
You just send me some email.
Okay.
Or you can go look it up on HTTP at www.bespoke, that's bespoke.org/Viridian, which is our website over in Denmark. We've got some Danish digital art guys who are sort of running this for us. And there's also a backup website in Australia. I enjoy doing this kind of fanzine activity over the net because it's so delightful to just whip things out and have receive some response from, you know, Azerbaijan or Nauru or, you know, Tanzania. It's really a lively and interesting thing.
One of the nonfiction pieces of yours that I read last year was your piece for Wired, where you went around the world following the laying of wires for the cables for the internet.
No, you've mistaken that for Neal Stephenson's article.
I'm sorry. You're right. But you've been writing for...
I went around the world for Wired looking at really large objects.
That's right.
You know, it's an easy mistake to make. I mean, Stevenson, Sterling, you know, that's three letters.
Well, I'm glad you're so forgiving.
I'm sure I'm selling a lot of work because people are grabbing my books because they're right next to Neil.
I read your article as well. It was about the big Chinese site and the atom smasher
right.
in Texas.
Yeah, Hong Kong and right. CERN. And I'm wearing my CERN T-shirt now, actually.
One of the ideas that's central to your Viridian Manifesto is the demand for more leisure, which, although you try to explicitly distance yourself from both left and right and contemporary green movements, your calls for a leisure-oriented social policy reminded me a lot of André Gortz's work on Pathways to Utopia, Farewell to the Proletariat. He's a post-Marxist who's written about a strategy for leading what he called the non-class of non-workers towards expanding the sphere of freedom. And I think there's actually the ligaments there of a real social policy.
Well, you know, there certainly is if you're a Marxist. I mean, the thing that bugs the hell out of me about the left and the right is that they both want you to just absolutely work your fingers to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're always making insane demands for people to sort of go out there and immerse themselves in huge, dedicated action. I mean, it's a kind of Stakhanovite effect on the left where you're kind of worshiping the guy who can stack more concrete blocks than anybody else. And on the right is this sort of fierce dedication to Victorian duty where you're supposed to have no time for yourself. And really, I think in both cases, these are ideologues who just believe that idle hands are the devil's workshop, and they don't want people to have any time to think. They don't want people to enjoy themselves or to find any happiness in their lives. They basically want people to be dedicated drones who are ready to salute and snap to whenever Mr. Wonderful goes to the podium. So I just resist this. You know, the times that I'm happiest have been when I'm just daydreaming or free associating or something shows up and I have time to look at it. And you know, I think it's the sort of social cement of society. It's time spent with your children, you know, time spent outside the market, time that isn't required of you. And I really think people are being slowly robbed of their leisure because, you know, in a lot of cases there's no more delineation between work and free time. It's like in Microsoft you can work any 18 hours a day you want. Mm-hmm. You know, but I just see this as a sinister trend, and I think it's dehumanizing.
In your latest novel, Distraction, which was published in 1999 or late 1998?
98.
I just finished that, and in Distraction, it's set about 50 years from now when deindustrialization and automation has robbed a lot of people of their jobs, and those people have accumulated in new computer-mediated communities, mobile refugee communities, which is another topic you address in the Viridian Manifesto. I know that science fiction isn't supposed to be a projection of the future, but it seems like a lot of the themes that you've addressed in the Viridian Manifesto are reflected in the novel Distraction about the way things may be ending up if we extrapolate current trends.
Well, you know, a few, but I don't think that novel is particularly realistic, and it's satirical and kind of, you know... I mean, it's like H.G. Wells used to say, you have to exaggerate everything by a factor of three, because if you just double it, people just think you're exaggerating, and if you exaggerate it by a factor of four, nobody can figure out what you're talking about. So you just want to triple it kind of for rhetorical effect.
Really?
You know, a novel is not reality. It's about ideas of the future, but it's not what my own... I mean, I don't think anything like that is particularly likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I just like the idea of people being sort of divorced from their atoms and living on their bits. And, you know, I think there's some small possibility of that going on. I mean, it's the thing that I think is most striking about the Internet as a social phenomenon is that it's so non-market-oriented. There's so much freeware there. And it's just, you know, it's sort of easy to... be very active there and get lots of data and lots of information without ever paying for it in any immediate sort of monetary way. And I'd like to see food handled like that, you know? I mean, I think there ought to be like a little computer-controlled, like, bread maker device, and I ought to be able to just, like, put long clippings in it and get out, I don't know, Cheerios. But you know, I don't think that's very far-fetched.
Hopefully not.
I think there's a lot of activity now in biological engineering, kind of genetic engineering, and just food processing, basically. You know, why not eat grass?
Well,
really.
Distraction.
Why should I pay for any food at all? And if I don't have to pay for food, and if I don't have to pay for shelter, and if I've also got a computer, suddenly, you know, why am I putting up with really anything?
Where
are the constraints?
Not
there?
That free food and shelter would have anything to do with that old socialist system or politics.
No, I don't think it would have anything to do with that. I think it would have everything to do with new means of production.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the things about Distraction that impressed me, and it was also very evident in Holy Fire, which was your 1996 novel about life extension, was, again, this somewhat critical but also very optimistic perspective on biotechnology. I think that's distinctive, that as opposed to those who are wholly embracing it or wholly critical, horrific about it, you project what it might actually be like to have to live in a newly revived body or in a genetically modified body as the protagonist of Distraction is.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, I feel the same way when I think about cars.
Mm-hmm. That you love them and you hate them.
It's a great thing, and I've got two of them, and they're all over the place. But, you know, if you're not also aware that, like, cars can crush your body or smash a small child,
mm-hmm.
you know nothing about cars.
Right. You
know, and cars are a technical artifact. So somebody says immortality, instead of, like, immediately thinking of, like, Greek myths of immortality or Platonic abstract notions of immortality, the first thing you should think is, what if this is like cars? You know, I mean, the very first question you should ask is, what does the underside of this look like?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are any number of people who will try to sell you the upside, so you sort of have to do the downside for yourself. But, you know, if it's a technology, it's going to be handled like other technologies. It's like worrying about rocket ships. It's like, you know, thinking of a rocket ship as some sort of symbol of transcendence, when in point of fact, a rocket ship is basically something like the Mir space station, something that leaks a lot and smells bad and air comes out of it, and it goes up there and you don't have any way to get it back down safely. And that's just the proper way to approach it.
Well, it seems to be the meditation for 1999 is Y2K, and I was struck that one of the sentences in the Viridian Manifesto is it should be considered a mark of stellar ignorance to be unaware of the source of one's electric power.
Yeah.
Are you consumed at all with concerns about Y2K?
I think it's going to create some difficulties of one kind or another, but I don't think that society is so tightly linked that Y2K problems are going to create absolute havoc. I mean, for one thing, if that were true, then every time there was a power outage, civilization ought to collapse.
Right. Well, Texas
because,
is.
When you think about it, if the power goes out, it's like it's a computer bug. It's, hey, your computer stops working. So, you know, if the power goes out in San Francisco, that's several million computers failing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that, by the reasoning of Y2K, this ought to lead to a chain reaction of destruction all across civilization, and in point of fact, it doesn't. So.
Well, I really appreciate your coming on the air with us.
Hey, I live to serve, man.
I'm glad you do. Are you working on another project now, or can we expect?
Yeah, I'm getting ready to go over to Turkish Cyprus here. That's what I'm researching right now. It's kind of tied in with an islands and the net thing. I'm going to go over there for Wired. And I'm very interested in these sort of semi-legal, semi-national entities. And turns out the Republic of Turkish Cyprus, which most people have never heard of, seems to be becoming a kind of island in the net thing.
So, oh, really?
I'm going to go over there and go drink Cypriot brandy and hang out and see what I can scare up without getting shot.
Sounds like the life.
Yeah.
Well, I've got links back to your website, the website that was set up with all of your work in it. And
there's several of those.
Yeah, around the world.
Yeah.
People do a search for Bruce Sterling. They can find many, many sites.
Oh, yeah.
But you can out the www.changesurfer.com/Event Horizon website, and that has links to Bruce Sterling's work. Thank you very much for joining us, Bruce.
Adios.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, jhughes, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.